I'd like to begin this lesson tonight with a couple of illustrations. One of them, a poem from Robert Frost. The poem is set in a beautiful New Hampshire fall woodcutting. And it describes circumstances that some of you, if you're not any older than I am, might even be able to identify with. The buzzsaw snarled and rattled in the yard, made dust and dropped stove-length sticks of wood, soft-scented stuff when the breeze drew across it. And from there, those lifted-up eyes could count five mountain ranges, one behind the other, under the sunset far into Vermont. And the saw snarled and rattled, as it ran light or had to bear a load. And nothing happened. Day was all but done. The first part of that scene is one that I think anybody with a rural background might be able to understand a little bit, as you can imagine, a fall woodcutting. But the rest of it reads like a nightmare. "Call it a day," I wish they might have said, to please the boy by giving him the half hour that a boy counts so much when saved from work. His sister stood beside them in her apron to tell them, "Supper!" At the word, the saw, as if to prove saws knew what supper meant, leapt out at the boy's hand, or seemed to leap. He must have given the hand. However it was, neither refused the meeting, but the hand. The boy's first outcry was a rueful laugh as he swung toward them, holding up the hand, half in appeal, but half as if to keep the life from spilling. Then the boy saw all, since he was old enough to know. Big boy, doing a man's work, though a child at heart. He saw all spoiled. "Don't let them cut off my hand. The doctor, when he comes, don't let him, sister." But the hand was gone already. The doctor put him in the dark of ether. He lay and puffed his lips out with his breath, and then the watcher at his pulse took fright. No one believed. They listened at his heart, little, less, nothing. And that ended it. No more to build on there. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. In this particular poem, Robert Frost describes a tragedy. A tragedy in which a young boy, not paying attention for just a slight second, loses his hand to a buzzsaw in this beautiful pastoral scene of a fall woodcutting. But the point behind this is not so much that it was just the loss of blood, but it was almost the loss of hope that we see in the young man. Here at the very verge of his life as a man, and now he looks and sees all spoiled as his hand is gone, missing, and losing hope, eventually loses his life. Robert Turner tells a story about a man he knew one time who had a crippling illness that made it to where both of his arms hung uselessly by his side. But this man took everything with a completely different spirit than most people do. Instead of allowing his handicap to get him down, he continued to be somebody of such dignity and such good humor that even when people had put his hat on, kind of crooked, knowing that he couldn't straighten it out, he could still wear a hat, even that was sideways, with dignity before everyone. One of the ways that especially impressed Brother Turner was the fact that when his boys, and he had several big old boys, needed disciplining, he couldn't discipline them in the normal way that somebody would discipline them, by spanking them. So what he did, he had those boys bend over and he kicked them in the seat of the pants. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about that is the fact that the discipline had to occur for those boys to stand there and take a kick in the seat of the pants. But it's interesting to notice that here's a man who, instead of seeing all spoiled, was one who was able to look at his handicap and not really allow it to serve as a handicap for him. All through my life, I've known people who have faced adversity and difficulty and even failure in ways that were so completely different. Some saw in mistakes all spoiled. Others seeing in those same kinds of situations hope. I think in this, I'd like to make a comparison tonight between Peter and Judas, because I think in the story of these two men, we see both of these attitudes expressed, and one that I'd like us to contemplate for just a few minutes this evening before we bring this series of meetings to an end. I think if we look at both of these men, we'll see just exactly what the attitude we should have when we find ourselves crippled by sin. Don't allow it to cripple us, but allow it to be something that puts us in a situation to where do we go to the place where we can find refuge, where we can find redemption, and where we can find hope. Judas is an interesting character. We see him being described in a situation in which Jesus was at Bethany, at the home of a man named Simon the leper. And there is an incident that occurs there that Mark's account ties in with the betrayal of Judas. I want you to notice, beginning in verse 3 and going to verse 9, it says, "Now while he was in Bethany," this is Jesus, "at the home of Simon the leper and reclining at the table, there came a woman with an alabaster vial of very costly perfume, of pure nard, and she broke the vial and poured it over his head. But some were indignantly remarking to one another, 'Why has this perfume been wasted? For this perfume might have been sold for over 300 denarii, over a year's wages, and the money given to the poor.' And they were scolding her. But Jesus said, 'Let her alone. Why do you bother her? She's done a good deed for me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you wish you can do good to them, but you do not always have me. She's done what she could. She's anointed my body beforehand for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be spoken of in memory of her.'" A story that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. To see, generally it's considered Mary of Bethany who takes this alabaster vial of ointment and anoints Jesus before his burial. But I want you to notice what Mark includes next in the next two verses. He says, "Then Judas Iscariot, who was one of the 12, went off to the chief priests in order to betray him to them. And they were glad when they heard this and promised to give him money. And he began seeking how to betray him at an opportune time." I don't know exactly what the situation was. He may have been one of the ones who said, "This is the money. This money could have been taken and used in so many other good ways." In fact, one of the other accounts implies that and says he didn't do this because he was concerned for the poor, but because he was a thief and he held the bag, took care of the treasury of the apostles, whatever meager funds they might have. But here, perhaps feeling rebuked by Jesus, we see him, maybe because of that being sulling up at Jesus, going out and betraying him at this particular point. Can you imagine someone who saw everything that all the other apostles saw and yet then goes out and betrays Jesus to his enemies? In the sixth chapter of the book of John, we see another situation here that is describing Jesus as he gives his bread of life sermon. And it tells us in verse 66 of chapter 6, after this sermon, it says, that as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. And Jesus said to the 12, "You do not want to go away also, do you?" Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." And Jesus answered, "Did I myself not choose you, the 12? And yet one of you is a devil." Now he meant Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, for he, one of the 12, was going to betray him. Perhaps it was at this point that as others saw Jesus not being the kind of Messiah that they had in mind, walk no more with him. Perhaps it was this situation in which we see Judas turning away and continuing to follow Jesus, but not with the same whole heart that he had before. He began to steal from the bag, as we mentioned before, in the 12th chapter of the book of John, verses 5 and 6, as it describes his situation with the rest of the apostles. It emphasizes this particular point. It tells us in verses 5 and 6, he said, now, and this, it refers back to the situation at Bethany, where he said, "Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii and given to poor people?" Now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief, and as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put into it. So as we talked about a few minutes ago, he's not concerned about the poor. At the Last Supper in the 13th chapter of the book of John, I want you to notice in verse 26, we see Jesus on the very night that Judas is going to betray him, Jesus warns Judas. He lets him know that, "I know what you're doing. I know what you've done." In verse 26, Jesus answered, "That is the one that I shall dip the morsel and give it to him." So when he had dipped the morsel, he took and gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And yet, when all of Jesus explains exactly what is going to happen, do you remember what the apostles say according to Matthew's account? "Surely not I, Rabbi. Surely not I." And yet, at that very moment, we see Judas going out to sell Jesus to the officials who were out for his life. Now afterward, when all was said and done, and when Jesus was arrested, and it appeared that he was going to be killed, Judas felt remorse. The problem is, his guilt and despair didn't go away. In the 27th chapter of the book of Matthew, we see here as it describes Judas' situation, it tells us, "Now when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, 'I have sinned by betraying innocent blood.' But they said, 'What's that to us? See to that yourself.' And he threw the 30 pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed and went away and hanged himself." When he realizes that he's done wrong, he goes to the power brokers to try to make things right. And when they have absolutely no concern about his situation, we see him in such despair, seeing all spoiled, that he goes out and takes his own life. He throws the 30 pieces of silver away, trying to pass on the responsibility to someone else. But finally, when he sees that Jesus has been condemned and he has remorse for it, he goes to everyone except to the very one who he has wronged and the very one through whom he could have sought forgiveness. Now, on the very night that Judas betrayed Jesus, we see Peter also denying that he knew Jesus. Peter was an impulsive and worldly person in some ways, just like Judas was. He was a fisherman out of Capernaum. We see him cursing and swearing on the night that Jesus was betrayed, trying to emphasize to people that he hadn't known Jesus at all. Satan sought Peter just like he had sought Judas. And we see in the book of Luke, in chapter 22, Jesus points this out to Peter on the same night that he tells Judas that Judas is going to betray him. In verse 31 of Luke, the 22nd chapter, Jesus tells him, "Simon, Simon, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. But I've prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and you, when once you've turned again, may strengthen your brothers." But he said to him, "Lord, with you I'm ready to go both to prison and to death." And he said, "I say to you, Peter, the rooster will not crow today until you've denied three times that you know me." You see, Jesus had Judas's number, but he has Peter's number too. He says, "Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat." How many times in our lives have we wondered if we were being sifted like wheat just to see exactly what we were made of? To see what kind of things were involved in us. Sifting flour is not as important as it used to be. But I can remember my mother having a sifter. It was kind of like a coffee can with a screen door on the bottom of it, and it had a handle to it that kind of shook. And it went down like a hanger and scraped the bottom of that screen door part of it. And you could take wheat and wheat flour, and you took it and you sifted it all the way down so everything would be nice and fluffy. But there were a couple of other reasons too. If you had some kind of bugs, or if you had lumps in your flour, or you had rocks in your flour, you had a way to be able to get that out before it went into your biscuits. Here he says, "I'm demanding permission to sift you like wheat." I've got your number, Peter. And he certainly did. But on that very night, we see him betraying Jesus just exactly like Judas did. He doesn't do it for money, but he denies that he knew Jesus three times before the cock crew. Later on, he decides he'll go back to his old trade after everything is done. In fact, Jesus has risen from the dead, and Jesus has appeared to Peter. And he finally, with a few other of the apostles in the 21st chapter of the book of John, says, "I go fishing." And the very tense of the verbs let us understand that what he's talking about is that he's planning on going back to fishing rather than just taking a fishing trip. But wound up being restored by the loving hand of Jesus Christ himself. Later, we see him walking the same impulsive path. You remember in the second chapter of the book of Galatians, when we find, in spite of the fact that he had been the first one to convert a Gentile, we see him showing hypocrisy when he has people from Jerusalem come up and see him associate with Gentiles to the extent that he withdraws from them. In the second chapter of the book of Galatians, beginning in verse 11, it says, "But when Cephas," which is the Aramaic name of Peter, "came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For prior to the coming of certain men from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles, but when they came, he began to withdraw and hold himself aloof, fearing the party of the circumcision. The rest of the Jews joined him in hypocrisy, with the result that even Barnabas was carried away by their hypocrisy. And when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in the presence of all, 'If you, being a Jew, live like the Gentiles and not like the Jews, how is it that you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews?'" You see, Peter was not a perfect man. He was impulsive. We see him at the time when, in this situation, he should have stood up. We see him backing down and having to be rebuked by Paul in this situation. On the very night that Judas hanged himself, Peter denied that he knew Jesus three times. Both of them had the opportunity to change. Luke's account, I think, is especially brutal when it comes to talking about Peter, because it tells us in Luke, the 22nd chapter, about the very occasion in which Peter made his third denial that Jesus was the Christ. In verses 60 through 62, it tells us, "But Peter said," here in his denial, his third denial, "Man, I don't know what you're talking about." And immediately while he was speaking, a rooster crowed. I want you to imagine, here he hasn't paid any attention to what Jesus has said all through this night, and now here he says this, pause. "And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him, 'Before a rooster crows today, you'll deny me three times.' And he went out and wept bitterly." I imagine so. Because he realized, probably only at that point, exactly what he had done and the nature of the betrayal that he himself had been involved in spite of his prior denial. Peter, though, became a great apostle. You remember in the second chapter of the book of Acts, he preaches the very first gospel sermon along with the 11. His account is the one that we have recorded for us. We see him being the one who is arrested with John and who there before a rump session of the same group that had Jesus crucified. We see him telling them that there is salvation in no one else, for there's no other name given under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Verse 12 of chapter 4. We see him in chapter 5 being one of the apostles who's beaten, and yet because they are beaten, they go from that place rejoicing because they've been considered worthy to suffer shame for his name after standing before the very same group that had Jesus crucified. In chapter 10, he converts the household of Cornelius as the one chosen to be the first one to convert one of our people and allow the gospel to spread throughout the whole world and not just be confined to the Jewish sphere. We see him at that great meeting that took place at Jerusalem, being the one who emphasizes that at the household of Cornelius, there was nothing said to him through inspiration that the Gentiles needed to be circumcised. He simply commanded them to be baptized. So here we see, I think, in Peter, someone who didn't go out and hang himself, but someone who was able to change and become useful in the Lord's service. One of them saw his mistakes and his failures and saw all spoiled. The other is able to come to Jesus and find forgiveness, and because of that, amount to something in the cause of Christ. And I think we've already come to the solution, and that is forgiveness. One loved Jesus and knew that Jesus was the one who he needed to go to because he had sinned against the Lord. The other went back to the power brokers of his day, and when he was rejected by them, he felt he had no place to go. We see Peter crying after he had betrayed Jesus. But yet, we find in the 21st chapter of the book of John, we see a different man, someone not as bold as the one before, but someone who is still willing to confess Jesus and to confess his love for Christ. In the 15th verse of chapter 21 in the book of John, it says, "So after they had finished breakfast," this is after a miraculous draft of fish has been brought in, very much like it was when Peter had first left his nets and gone and followed Jesus. This is something that occurs after the resurrection here in this particular story. Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And he said, "Tend my lambs." He said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know I love you." And he said to him, "Shepherd my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." What's the difference between Peter and Judas in the stories that we've looked at? One is Peter wasn't destroyed by what he had done. Jesus can't use spiritual cripples. But He can use those who, once destroyed by sin, realize that they need to come to the Lord and rise above it. So in effect, what the Lord tells him is, "Rise above it, tend my lambs, shepherd my sheep, tend my sheep." Just as He had denied him three times, He gives him three times to assert his love for the Lord, and each time shows his confidence in Him by giving him a powerful task to perform. "Do my work," he says. And Peter is the one who is not completely devastated by what he has done, and is allowed to be the one who becomes the apostle who we all know and love and appreciate the great work that he did. What's your attitude towards sin? Is your attitude one in which you look at the things that you've done that are wrong and allow those to drag you down, to cripple you? Do you see all spoiled? Let me tell you, we serve a Lord that's able to forgive no matter what you have done. Remember several years ago, I don't know the details of this particularly. I've heard about it. But you remember Jeffrey Dahmer, it was said, was baptized into Christ in the last few weeks of his life, and was just before he was killed, was baptized by a gospel preacher. I don't know the preacher's name, but I've heard that persistently over the last several years. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. But you know one thing I do know? Is even a mass murderer, even someone who did the terrible things that he did, if he comes to the Lord in faith, repenting of what he's done that's wrong, confessing that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, he can approach the watery grave of baptism and his sins can all be washed away no matter what he's done. I know people who, because of things that they've done in war, have thought, "The Lord can't forgive me." I've known people because of their unfaithfulness over the years. There was a fellow several years ago that I knew who was from West Texas. I think he was from Lubbock. And was faithful when he was a young man, but since his marriage, he had not been faithful. And now, in his 60s, had started coming back to services. Came on a regular basis, and I finally approached him one time about what his spiritual condition was. And he says, "You know, I thought after being unfaithful for so many years, the Lord would never be able to forgive me." Let me tell you, the Lord can forgive you. And the Lord promises that He can forgive you. Just don't let sin kill you like Judas did. Be someone who's able to go to the Lord and be able to find the forgiveness that's made available in Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone. When you've done something that's wrong, it's terrible. But do you know what? All is not spoiled if we come to the Lord and we make things right with Him through baptism and initial obedience into Christ. And when we become Christians, if we decide that we'll go to the Lord in forgiveness, we've also found a situation in which the forgiveness of Jesus can help us to be once again what He would have us to be. As the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter and verse 11, about Christians, you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified. Do you see, all of those things are things that are possible for those who, instead of allowing themselves to be ruined by sin, are able to go back to the Lord to find the forgiveness that they need to have. Will you allow sin to ruin you tonight? Or will you do like Peter and determine that you're going to do better in the Lord's service and you're going to seek forgiveness from Him? If that's the case, we offer obedience to the gospel to you, and we can baptize you this very evening so that you can leave this place washed in the blood of the Lamb. If you as a child of God haven't lived as you should, you need to confess your sinfulness as widely known as it has become. You need to let your brethren know of your desire to do things better and make up your mind you're going to go to even greater service. There's two choices that we have out there when it comes to sin. We can be like Judas and let it ruin us, or we can be like Peter, who, in spite of the fact that they both messed up on the same night, were people whose responses were so completely different. Please be like Peter. And please seek in the Lord the forgiveness that He makes available to you this very evening. If we can help anyone make things right with their Lord this evening, we encourage you to come while together we stand and sing.